Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across northern British Columbia. Casting today from the traditional territories of the Kleklaytane and Tsingtian First Nations are your hosts.
I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
You're listening to QualityCast North. Welcome back, listeners. This week, we're turning our attention to violence and mental health. All too commonly, we read in the media about acts of violence brought against innocent citizens by those with mental health disorders in people's homes and on the streets of our towns and cities. It may not come as a surprise to you, therefore, that these acts of violence also occur regularly in our healthcare facilities and hospitals against healthcare staff and even other patients. But what can be done about this seemingly intractable and all too prevalent problem? To talk about this issue, how we got here, and possible solutions, is our guest today, a psychiatrist and Northern Health's regional medical lead for mental health services, Dr. Barb Kane. Hi, Barb. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Cher. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the topic and the issue, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your role. What does this role involve, and how long have you been in this role?
Okay, so I've been the what's called the medical lead for mental health for Northern Health since 2018. This was a new position. No one had ever had it before. When Northern Health was trying to, I think, improve or build up its co-leadership model in the mental health administration. They did it in other areas as well, but this is when I started. So, I mean, I can talk a little bit about how it started. Because it was new, they asked me what I wanted to work on. And I said that one of the topics that I wanted to work on was the people who stayed on our psychiatric ward for a long time. Because at that point, we had two patients. One had stayed on our ward for about 3 years and one for about 5 years, which is not what is supposed to be happening in a general hospital psychiatric ward. The stays are supposed to be much shorter than that, at the most in months, but more average in weeks or days even. So the reason these people couldn't be discharged, even though we tried to discharge them to various places, and we did discharge them a couple of times, but they come right back, was mostly because of violence. Violence and obviously their mental health problem. So originally when I started doing this, I wanted to know sort of what the scope of the problem was, not only in Prince George, but also in Northern Health in terms of people with these really long stays. For, you know, violence wasn't the only reason, but it was certainly one of the main ones. And it turned out there were quite a few more than I expected. So it was definitely having a significant impact on our hospitals, on the psychiatric wards. So because if we can't get everybody out of the ward, then other people who need to be there can't get in. And so if you have psychiatric patients who come into the emergency and there's no beds on our ward, then they either stay in the emergency for quite a while, which isn't ideal by any means, or they go to other wards sometimes, which is not ideal. And then those beds on other wards mean, you know, if patients go to a surgical ward, it means then people can't get admitted for surgery either. So that's a problem for the whole. It turned out actually that as we looked at our numbers, it wasn't only affecting the psychiatric ward, which was what I thought. It was affecting the whole hospital and many of the hospitals across Northern Health. So that was a bit of an eye opener. I hadn't realized how much it was affecting the rest of the hospital by having patients who couldn't be discharged. The other thing I was going to mention about that was my original idea was that I'd get a sense of the scope of the problem to see what we needed to develop in the community, what kind of community resources we needed to have. But over the course of the last 6 or 7 years that I've been doing this, I've realized that community resources aren't going to manage violent people. So violent people need to be in hospitals for the most part. If they have violence and mental illness, they need a higher level of care than being in any kind of community resource, because community resources won't tolerate that. They don't have the ability to look after those kind of people. And that's why we needed to have a higher security unit, like we're hoping to get. And the one that's the option right at the moment is the Prince George Youth Containment Center that closed down about 2 years ago. But it has all the security that we would need, and a lot more as well. So that's the kind of resource that we need for the really severe people with violence. And then you get the right kind of staff there. And just, I'll just talk about as well, if you can, if you're all right with it, I'll just talk about the fact that when I, again, when I started doing this, there were thoughts that having small units around the north, or even in the province, because this is really a problem for the whole province, not just for us, that it would be more, I don't know, maybe humane or something like that, to have smaller units rather than bigger institutions. But this is another thing that I've learned, is that the smaller units can't manage the violence the way a bigger unit can, because you need to have enough people around 24/7 that you've got enough staff to deal with violent incidents. And I mean, for example, Riverview Hospital, which was closed in 2012, I can talk about that in a minute, but Riverview Hospital never had to phone the police to get help with violence. Riverview Hospital could handle the violence themselves because they had the trained staff, and they had enough of them that they could deal with violence without having to take it to another hospital. Whereas if you have smaller community resources that they don't have the enough rotation of enough staff, then if somebody gets violent, they have to call the police. And if they have to call the police, then the police take them to the hospital, and then we're back at the same problem that we had before. So it has sort of changed. This last 6 or 7 years has changed my thinking in a way to say that, yes, we do need somewhat institutional care for this really high level of patient with mental illness. So that's kind of the...
Sure, thank you. And just to clarify, Barb, so the violence that we're talking about, this is physical violence directed at...
Oh, yeah.
Other or people, or anybody, or staff, or
it could be staff, it could be, oh, I mean, it's staff, probably mostly staff, and then sometimes the other patients. I don't know that would be very often, like visitors, I don't think, but yeah, staff definitely. So the staff, our staff have been, you know, kicked and hit and bit, and one of them was in a chokehold in the last year, and another one who was trying to get them out of that ended up with a fractured leg. So there's all kinds of violence that, you know, you never hear about, because it doesn't all make the news. There's way more that goes on than people know about. I mean, there have obviously been incidents of violence. You know, the one I'm thinking of most recently, I think, was a nurse got stabbed in the emergency department in Vancouver General, by a psychiatric patient. And I think the reason that one became known was because there were, you know, lots of other patients in the emergency department who reported it. It's not like the hospitals are letting people know how many people get hurt on individual cases. So yeah, it happens more than people know about. I think part of the reason is because Riverview closed in 2012. So when it closed, it was the only psychiatric hospital in BC. And what they did was they sent, they had people who they put in various placements around the province. They did build 20 bed, sort of like group homes around the province. And a lot of people from Riverview went into those group homes, but there was a subset that couldn't even get out of Riverview, and some of those went into hospitals, like general hospitals, which wasn't really the idea. And then the problem was there was really no place for the new people coming up with, mental illnesses who were violent. And on top of that, and I, on top of that, the drug problem became so bad. The drug problem just escalated everything. And then the resource where we might have been able to use to deal with a lot of those people with drug problems disappeared. And that was Riverview, because a lot of, some of the drugs, or a lot of the drugs, make people pretty violent as well.
Could I ask you, Bob, what do you think was the reason behind the original closure of Riverview Hospital? And aren't the same reasons still relevant today, or what's changed, do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm not sure. I think it was a mixture of things. So I'm going back a bit far, but in the 1950s, there was something like 4,300 beds at Riverview. By the time it closed, it had about 800. But what happened in the 1950s is that new drugs were developed that we didn't have before. So those new drugs, I think, led to an optimism that we could look after people in the community. And we could look after a lot more people in the community when they took these drugs. However, over time, it sort of has become clear that the drugs aren't, they're good, but they're not good enough for everybody. And I think it was also there were, seemed to be some abuses going on in the involuntary hospitals. So that was another thing. And I think it was also the idea that we could beef up community resources, and community resources would take the place of psychiatric hospitals. So I think it was all those things that led to the reduction. Or, I mean, in BC, it wasn't just a reduction, it was a complete closure, which is not what most places did. To my knowledge, there's only one other place in the world that completely closed their psychiatric hospital, and that was Italy. And what happens, or what happened, I think, somewhat in Italy, is it led to what happens in a lot of places as the number of psychiatric, they've done research that shows as the number of psychiatric beds is reduced, the number of people in jail goes up. So it's like there's a set number that, but that didn't really had, or in the last few years, that hasn't happened here, I think, because of the way our courts are have changed. But that's led to, I think what it's led to now here is that we have way more people on the street. And so that's one of the things that has happened. And what was the other one I was thinking of? Yeah, and I think that it's led to a lot more drug use as well. So on the street, which is pretty devastating, as we've all seen. But I think those were the reasons. I think maybe to some extent, I think it's a bit of wishful thinking. People wanted that to be the case, but in what actually happened, didn't pan out that way. So, I mean, there's been many, many different sort of government initiatives, or the way people think about things, that's been too positive and it hasn't worked. So, all sorts of areas, not just in psychiatry. But I think that's what's happened that led to this. And people want to be nice to everybody. They don't want to have to lock them up, or, but it just doesn't work for some people.
So let's go back to, and you alluded to this earlier, to your proposed solution. not rebuilding Riverview by any means, but maybe a cut down version. And so tell us about this solution that you see as a potential here in the northern in Prince George.
Yeah, okay. Well, we've been looking at numbers over the years in terms of how many people would need this level of care. It's a little hard to estimate, but when we initially looked at the numbers that we thought would need this really high level secure care, it was at least 50. I mean, that was sort of the bottom line. And as it turns out, the Youth Containment Center has 61 beds, I believe. So that is good because it allows to have, I think it's going to allow us to have different types of units with different types of problems. Depends on what we decide we need, because there really are different levels of care and problems. We haven't decided yet exactly how we would do it, but we undoubtedly have one for the really severe, sort of more pure, I guess you could say, mental illnesses. There'll probably be one for mixtures of severe mental illness and drug use.
And just to be clear, this is the youth detention center is a center that has been previously closed. Is that?
Yeah, it was closed about 2 years ago. So, well, not that long ago. So it has all the one of the advantages, it has all the security that we need. And of course, and it's got a lot of other things too. It's got a big gym, and it's got a, I think it's got a quite a few other recreation areas, art shop. When they built it for the youth offenders, they built it with the idea of a certain amount of rehab as well. It's got lots of outdoor space that's behind the fence.
What are the steps required as you see it? What are the steps required to see a new facility like the one you propose become a reality?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the advantages, obviously, is having a new facility or a facility already there, is that we don't have to start from scratch. So it certainly costs a lot less to do it that way than if we were having to start from the beginning. I mean, that would be not only that would cost us both money and time. So this way, it's having the ability to use the Youth Containment Center means that we can most likely do something way faster and for a lot less money. I think the big there will imagine we don't know this yet, but I know that people have looked at it about in terms of what kind of renovations it might need. And I think there will be some. So but I don't know how much that's gonna cost. We don't know that yet, but there are people working on that. So that will have to be done, and that'll take some time as well. And then you've got to we have to work on exactly, what are we going to do with it? What sort of units are we going to have? I think we're also going, then you have to, we have to, be looking for staff as well. Staff's obviously a huge issue. But there's a lot of people who like to work with really difficult people. So, and we have, nurses and other staff in, I know in Prince George, and I suspect there might be some from other northern areas, maybe even from southern areas who want to come and work at somewhere like that, because there really isn't anything in much in the whole province. We will be kind of unique if we do get it. So there's staffing, and we also have the I'm not sure how many of them are still around, but anyone who used to work at the Youth Containment Center, would be probably a good asset because they worked with adolescents. They had to have, I presume they had to have a lot more training in talking to people, and maybe more so than they do at the adult jail. Now, I don't want to, and maybe there's people from the adult jail who want to come there too, because they do have a skill set that I think would be useful in a place like this. But staffing will definitely be one of the big big things at the beginning. However, the fact that it's broken into these five different units, I think suggests that we could start it kind of sequentially. We don't have to open the whole thing all at once. You know, we can get one unit up and running and then get another one. And so I'm not sure if that's how it will go, but I think that's certainly a way it could go. Because it you know, we're going to have challenging people in that, in there. So it's going to be, you know, you wouldn't want to, I'm sure we wouldn't start it all up at once anyway. But it's going to take, I'm sure there'll be some growing pains as it gets going. Yeah.
And are there any hurdles sort of financially or politically that need to be met?
I don't think we know financially yet, but I think on the political side, the government seems to be saying that they're interested in doing something. They have another similar type of unit that they're doing, or two of them, I think, in the Lower Mainland. They're not as big as ours, but they seem to be interested in doing something. So that, I think that's a plus for sure. But, you know, it's costing us money not to have a place like this. You know, if I my office is in downtown Prince George, and you know, I'm right within a block of the two buildings. One blew up and one burned down, most likely somewhat related. I'm not saying it's all related, but it's definitely not unrelated to the fact that we don't have either the kind of places that could help people who are out on the street, or yeah, I mean, that's, I think it's a factor. You know, the windows get broken. Some people have had so many windows broken in their businesses, and all kinds of security, you know, with, you know, you can see bars on everything now, or pull down like garage door things in front of windows. That's all, you know, business owners are all paying for that stuff. And that's all over the place. That's a cost. It's not a cost specifically to the government, but it's a cost that society is dealing with by not having the right kind of services for people who really cannot look after themselves. I mean, they can't fix themselves. The people that I deal with in mental health, the severity level, they can't fix themselves. They don't. They have to have medication, and they often have to have it involuntarily because they, not forever always, but sometimes always, sometimes forever. There are illnesses that don't get better. And so all that costs money, whether it's, you know, whether we deal with it or not, we're still paying for it, I think. And another cost, I think, is the police services and the fire services and ambulance and all those people, paramedics. They deal with it. They're really the first line now for a lot of mental health issues. So that's all. I'm sure those budgets, I'm positive they've all gone up in the last few years since Riverview closed. So there's an awful lot of costs if we don't do something. And it's just, and our hospitals are, you know, to some extent, they're a disaster. Because what happens is, I'll sort of repeat myself a little bit here, but if psychiatric patients can't get up to our ward and they go, let's say, to surgery. So if they're on the surgery ward for, let's say there's 52 psychiatric patients on the surgery ward, and they're all in there for a week. That's a whole year of surgery, a surgery bed that can't be used for surgery patients.
Yeah, you know, I just listened to you talk about all the different impacts, and I can't help but think of something called whole system. And you were talking about the costs. And if you looked at that whole system approach, so you know, from the patient, the family, their community, our health professionals, and then all the other different bodies. And so what a huge impact. And again, multi-layered. And you've spoken about several things very concisely about what moving towards making a difference in this. And I have a question. It's like, what can those listeners of this podcast, what can they do to help? You know, because we all have, you know, we all have a stake in here. And do you have any suggestions there?
Well, I think people have helped a lot. Like one of the things that happened roughly last June was a petition went out asking the provincial government to work with Northern Health to develop a psychiatric hospital. And we've got not quite 5,000 signatures, but it's getting close, between people who actually signed the forms and people who went online. So they can go online. It's change.org, and you punch in Northern BC Psychiatric Hospital and you could sign the petition there. I was at I had a booth one time at the hockey game, and there was some lady who was pulling people over. I don't even know who she was, but she was going around and recruiting people to sign it. Sign the petition. So, I mean, people who I don't know have just like come out of the woodwork, a lot of them, to help out. So it's been pretty impressive that way, to me anyway, to see the community do that.
Thank you. And to just spring off that, I mean, you also have dedicated a large proportion of your career and to this regional role and to this issue as the medical lead for mental health in Northern Health. And you're also quite possibly one of the longest running medical leads I think the organization have actually had. So may I ask, what keeps you motivated in this role? What gets you out of bed each morning?
I think it's really so many days at work. It's just, we don't have the right resources for people. And we're in these terrible situations sometimes where we can't really keep people in the hospital, but that we shouldn't be letting them out either. And so we have this, you know, I guess that moral distress they talk about, which, and we have it a lot. It's not just me, it's lots of people, but lots of people in the profession. And I'm talking also about the nurses and, you know, the social workers and everybody sees what happens when, you know, you keep somebody in the hospital who you know is a risk when they go out, but you can't keep them in. So, I mean, I think that's what motivates, one of the things that motivates me, because, you know, I've let some people out that I think that this at some point, this isn't going to go well. And, you know, if somebody gets hurt, I'm not going to feel good about it. So I think that's one of the motivations. I think I've also have the advantage of having worked under the system when it was working better. I mean, it wasn't perfect before, but at least in the last, you know, the first 15 years when I was up here, it worked way better than it does now. And so I have seen that. Whereas, for example, I think a lot of the new people coming up, they only know this system. They don't know that it can be better. And so I think it's easier in some ways for me to advocate, because I know it can be better. I know we can do better than we are. It's not, it doesn't have to be like this. It worries me in some ways about what's going to happen. Because the people with really severe mental illnesses have been kind of left at the wayside without having a psychiatric hospital.
Thank you, Bar, for that. And we've reached the end of the interview now, but I'd just like to thank you for your continuing hard work and advocacy for this really challenging but important healthcare and societal issue. And I'd also like to thank you personally for your work with these patients, which I'm sure is challenging and difficult on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. So thank you for that. But unfortunately, I can hear the closing music, which means it is time to wrap things up. And
Okay, well, thank you very much.
yeah, no, thank you for coming on. And
thanks for your interest, then.
That's quite all right. As a token of our thanks on the podcast, we always send our guests one of our exclusive and highly coveted Quality Cast North coffee mug. So look out for that one coming to you in the mail. If you, the listener, would like to know more about today's topic and the petition for advocating for a secure mental health unit in Northern BC, do check out this episode's show notes, either on your podcast platform or through our website, nhpqi.ca/podcast. But until next time, it's goodbye from us here at Quality Cast North. I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
If you enjoyed today's episode, check out our other episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts, and subscribe to our channel. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for us about healthcare quality improvement, email us at qualitycons@northernhealth.ca, and your question could feature on a future episode. QualityCast North is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program of the Specialist Services Committee, a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation for the provincial health authorities. This episode was co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Lee Cameron, with technical support from Levi Giles and Matt Walker of Expression North. Original music by Daniel Chewy. Further information about today's guest is available in our show notes on our website at nhpqi.ca.